So let's start with a short meditation. So finding a nice, comfortable posture. So we begin by preparing the body, setting it in a state of ease and relaxation. Using the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension in any part of the body. And if you find it helpful, you can take 3 slow, deep breaths, maintaining awareness of sensations throughout the body as you breathe. And simply allow the breathing to flow naturally, effortlessly. And then setting the mind in a state of ease and relaxation. By letting go of any hopes or fears, worries or concerns about the past or the future. And simply allowing the mind come to rest in the present moment. Simply focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. And then narrow your focus and simply focus on the sensations of the breath at the entrance of the nostrils. And maintaining an ongoing flow of mindfulness of the sensations of the breath throughout the entire cycle of each in and out breath. Making sure that we're not tensing any muscles in the face. The eyes soft and relaxed. And that we're not trying to control or manipulate the breath in any way. Simply allow it to flow naturally. you find that you've become distracted, then without getting upset, simply relax, release the distraction, and then very gently return to focusing on the breath. Or if you find that you're simply becoming dull or spaced out, then use the in-breath as an opportunity to arouse and refresh your focus. And then we can set a positive motivation for our time together today. So try to generate the best possible motivation you can. And try to include others in your motivation as well. So let's start with a short review of what we've covered so far before we move on. So we're using this text, Lamrim Chenmo, or the Great Treatise on the Stages of the Path to Enlightenment by Lama Tsongkhapa, as the framework for our discussions. And of course, Lama Tsongkhapa was the founder of the Gelug school of Tibetan Buddhism. And this text is based on a structure of practice that was brought into Tibet from great Indian master Lama Ratisha in the 11th century. And he wrote a text called Lamp for the Path. And this outlines, this Lamrim structure, of course, like all structures, outlines step-by-step method to practice to strive on the path to enlightenment. And so far what we've done is we've had a look, we saw that the first topic in the Lamrim to reflect on is how to rely on a teacher, the root of the path. And so, of course, a teacher is going to be very helpful. If we have a personal teacher, be very helpful for us in the spiritual path, because they will be able to tailor the path, the practices, to our own specific capacities and needs. And they can also help us to overcome obstacles and correct any mistakes in our practice. So they can really make it most effective for us, because we don't really have unlimited time to experiment with all sorts of things and to learn from mistakes. This takes time. But of course, when this text was written at that time, then without a teacher, we couldn't even really begin to do anything. So really, in those days, that was the very first thing we had to do. We had to find a teacher. Otherwise, we couldn't begin to do anything. But of course, nowadays, we have a lot of books available. We have a lot of teachings available. So without a personal teacher, of course, now we can begin to do some study and reflection and meditation. But again, having said that, if we can really find a personal teacher who can guide us personally, this would be a great benefit to us. So then in the Lamrim, following that topic, then it's the second part, which is the rest of the text, is the stages of how the students train their minds after having relied on the teacher. And the very first topic there we saw was this exhortation to take full advantage of a life of leisure and opportunity. So what this, of course, is talking about is to reflect on our precious human life. The fact that we're not just human, but we're human with a lot of good conditions, living in a time and place where we have easy access to the teachings. Also, we have opportunity, we have desire, faith to try to implement some of these ideas. And so here, of course, this is coming next, this topic, because we often fail to appreciate this. We don't really appreciate the opportunity we have. And as with many things in our life, we only appreciate something as we're about to lose it or we've already lost it. So we, by reflecting on this precious human life, then we'll really appreciate the opportunities that we have. And of course, if we have some faith or belief in rebirth and understand what are the various possibilities of existence, then we can also see that this is very rare, this opportunity we have. And that if we end up in some other type of existence, it would be very difficult to achieve this type of life again. So if we have some faith and belief in rebirth, then that sort of reflection as well can also help us to really appreciate the preciousness of this human life. And of course, if we have no belief in rebirth, then the same would apply, because if we have no belief in rebirth, then we have this precious opportunity, but it's not going to last forever, and we've only got one opportunity. It's not going to come again. So then that would also inspire us to make most use of this human life. So whether or not we believe in rebirth, I think if we reflect on our precious human life, this would really inspire us to make our life meaningful. But then, of course, the question is, how can we make our life meaningful? And so here in the Lamb Rim structure, it breaks that up into three levels, in three more expanding levels of how to make our life meaningful. So here we have the presentation of the three types of persons, of small capacity, medium capacity, and great capacity. And so what we saw here was that a person of small capacity would simply want to make their life meaningful in terms of striving for a good future. A good future that would involve trying to avoid suffering as much as possible. And so, of course, here, again, it's within the context of the idea of rebirth, this cycle of existence called samsara. So here in the Lamb Rim, we're talking about small capacity, someone striving to have the same sort of good conditions that they have now in future lives, that would continue to strive to have at least that level. In the Lamb Rim here, that's what's called high status. So high status is simply a good level of existence, not ending up in a type of future where we have too much suffering. Of course, even if we don't believe in rebirth, I think we can still have this striving for a good future within this life. But of course, we want to make, or we would like to, at the minimum level, to make our life meaningful, at least not suffer too much in the future of this life. So I think, again, whether or not we believe in rebirth, we can follow these same sort of practices here. So how can we strive for this good future? And within all of these three levels of person, small, medium, and great capacity, it's sort of divided into two parts. The first part is the practices to help us to develop the aspiration. The second part is, what practices do we need to do to ensure that goal that we're going to strive for? So here, how to help us to develop this aspiration for a good future, we have two reflections, two topics. The first, of course, is mindfulness of death, to really contemplate that this life is not going to last forever. In fact, we don't know how long it's going to last. So therefore, let's make it as meaningful. Let's make it meaningful right now. Because even if we reflect on precious human life, there can still, and understand that we should make our life meaningful, there still can be this idea, well, you know, I'm going to live a long time. I can sort of do that spiritual, meaningful stuff later on. I'm sort of busy now. And we keep putting it off and we never begin. And then, of course, later in our life, we're full of regrets at having not really made our life very meaningful. So to avoid that, then we can reflect here on mindfulness of death or death and impermanence to really inspire us to make our life meaningful right now, not to delay. And then the second part was then to reflect on what is possible in our future. You know, what possible types of experiences could we have in the future? And here we talked about these two types of beings. Effectively, what we're talking about is a sort of a future existence where it's a good existence, or a future existence where it's not so good, having a lot of suffering. And so in particular here at this level of practice, then we can reflect on the fact that, well, we don't really want to have a lot of suffering in the future. Therefore, by reflecting on not wanting that, then we can develop the aspiration of striving for a good future, because we don't really want to have that in this life or future lives. And so by doing these two reflections, then we can really develop this aspiration to want to strive for a good future. And then, of course, how can we do that? You know, how can we achieve this happiness in the future of this life or in the future lives? And so here, then, we have two topics to reflect on. And we're in currently in the first one, that is training in going for refuge. So, you know, who or what can we rely on to help us to find that happiness or that freedom from suffering in the future? And so here we have the topic of the three jewels. So the analogy here we have was similar to, you know, if we have some illness and we want to overcome that illness, then who or what can we rely on? Who or what can we turn to for refuge? And so there, of course, we turn to refuge to the doctor, because we believe the doctor is qualified and is a valid source of refuge, because that doctor can hopefully help us to overcome our illness. But then, of course, what's really going to help us to overcome our illness is not the doctor. So we can praise the doctor all we want, but that's not really going to help us overcome our illness. What's going to help us is the doctor's advice, what his prescription is, he will be able to hopefully diagnose our illness and then give us a solution, a remedy, some sort of cure. And so the actual source of refuge for our illness is the medicine. But again, just having the medicine in our hand is not going to overcome our illness. We have to actually take the medicine. So the medicine here, of course, is like the Dharma. So, of course, we can have the best teachings in the world in our hand, but merely knowing that is not going to really help us. We have to internalize these teachings. We have to experience these teachings. We have to come to realize these. That will transform our mind. That will protect us from suffering. So just like swallowing the medicines, what's going to protect us from our illness, or whereby realizing, internalizing these teachings, that's what's going to really protect us from our suffering. So that's actually the actual refuge that we're going to. But then, of course, we have the Sangha, which is like the analogy of the nurses, will sometimes help us to recover if we have to recover in hospital. So the Sangha or spiritual community are the spiritual practitioners around us who help us to implement the Dharma, who support us in implementing the Dharma. So these are the three jewels that we can turn to for refuge. And so that's where we left off yesterday afternoon. There's just a couple more points I want to talk about refuge before we move on to the next topic, that is the topic of karma. So if we go into our outlines here, and then we can go sort of to the middle of page 10. It says here, once you have gone for refuge, the stages of the precepts. So once we have taken refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, then there are certain precepts that we are to follow to really be able to implement that refuge, so that it doesn't go astray, that we can really follow that source of refuge. And so I want to just go down and look briefly at the ones that are mentioned down the bottom of page 10, where it says how they appear in the oral tradition. And so here the special precepts. It says the proscriptive precepts and the prescriptive precepts. So proscriptive precepts are the things that we are to avoid, and the prescriptive precepts are the things that we are to engage in. So proscriptive, it says here, there are three. And the first says, not going to other deities for refuge. So each of these three is respectively related to Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. So by going for refuge into the Buddha, then the proscriptive precept is to not go for refuge to other deities. So what does that mean? To really clarify that, I want to read what it says in the actual Lamrim Chenmo for this precept. So this is on page 194. Not going to other deities for refuge is explained as follows. Since you should not even hold worldly deities such as Rudra and Vishnu as your ultimate refuge, what need be said about Nagas? Nagas is one of the other types of beings in the samsara, and the local divinities who are hungry ghosts. While it is improper to entrust yourself to these beings without full belief in the three refuges, it is proper to merely seek these beings' help for some temporary purpose. Just as, for example, you would seek help of a benefactor in acquiring the means of livelihood or consult a doctor for the cure of an illness. So what this really means is that in terms of the ultimate source of refuge, in terms of really overcoming the suffering and its causes, then the Buddha is the valid source of refuge. And certainly we can, like it said in the text here, if we are ill, then we can take refuge in the doctor and get cured. So there's no problem there. So that's not saying we're not allowed to do that anymore. Then the second one, which is relating to the Dharma, and if we take refuge in the Dharma, then we are to abandon harm and malice toward living beings. Because in the Dharma, here, the basis of the Dharma, of course, that we're going to look at is ethical lifestyle. So if we're really taking refuge in the Dharma, then we should not really be harming any sentient beings, any living beings, because that would go against the Dharma. And the third one says, not befriending non-Buddhist philosophers. Because the Sangha, the spiritual community that we are entrusting ourselves to for support, then the opposite of that would be to entrust ourselves to people who are bad companions, who are leading us astray in the wrong direction. So that's what this third one means here. So these are three things we are to avoid if we're going to refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. And then there are three things to engage in related to Buddha, Dharma, Sangha in the prescriptive precepts. It says here the first, which related to the Buddha, is to treat images of the Buddha as objects of reverence. So what this means is to have respect for images and statues and so forth that are an image or a symbol of the Buddha, to show respect. The second one is similarly to the Dharma, never to show disrespect for the writings on the teaching. So again, the actual texts are of course the basis for the Dharma, and so also to show respect for those texts. And what you find often in the Tibetan tradition, then, if you're ever in a Tibetan community, then they would very, very much be, if they're in a teaching area and there's a lot of people with texts, they'd be very careful not to walk over even the top of a text, because that for them is showing disrespect. And then the third one here is never to revile or despise members of the community, renunciates or those who merely possess symbols of practitioner. So here again, if we are going for refuge to the Sangha, the spiritual community, is to also show respect for the spiritual community around us. So these are the prescriptive precepts. Any questions about any of those six?
Mm-hmm. The one that's prescriptive and the one that's prescriptive.
Yeah.
The language still sounds to me like the Buddha is a god, right? It's obviously like one of my issues.
Right.
So what in particular is uncomfortable? What language?
The words other deities.
Right. Yeah. So here the word deity, the word deity here is a translation of the Sanskrit word deva. So it's talking about, in this wheel of life, these beings that have a lot of pleasure and live very sort of pleasurable lives, and they often have some sort of capacities as well. And so then to place our hope and faith in that they will be able to liberate us from suffering is misplaced faith, because they themselves are still stuck in samsara. So that's what it means to not go for refuge to them. You know, particularly in Tibetan culture, you know, we had a lot of these sort of worldly gods. So these worldly gods are belonging to this type of existence. Okay, they have a much better life than us in terms of pleasure and so forth, but in terms of being able to help us to break free from samsara, they're not really going to be able to do that for us. So that's what it's saying here, is that if we place our faith and into beings such as this, they're not really going to be able to help us very much. So that's what it means to not go for refuge to other deities. Personally, I find this use, the way they've translated that deva here as deity, is a bit misleading, because particularly in Tibetan Buddhism, we talk about in the Tantra deity practice. And there we're talking about different aspects of enlightened beings that we use as the practice. So that's not what we're talking about here. So that's why I find when they use this word deity, I feel a bit uncomfortable, because then people who are familiar with Tibetan Buddhism, they see this, oh, we're talking about like Tara and Manjushri, because they're deities, so why can't we go for them for refuge? So that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about these sort of worldly beings that are still stuck in samsara. These beings can't really help us very much. So we shouldn't place our faith in them. That's what it means here, not to go for refuge to other deities.
In the prescriptive precepts, my issue was with the word reverence, which to me is a different thing from respect.
Again, I don't know what the Tibetan word they've translated here is. I mean, I found that they've used here to translate, I find a little bit awkward, personally. Again, I'd have to look at the Tibetan text to see what they're... I think here reverence simply means to show respect. Because these images and statues are symbolizing the actual Buddha. So if we're really having faith and respect in the Buddha, but then we're treating these symbols of the Buddha in a bad way, that's sort of, somehow it's not quite right there. I mean, if you really, like, if there's a person in your life that you really admire and respect, and you had a picture of that person, but then you threw that picture on the ground, I mean, that somehow wouldn't really feel right, would it? You know, the picture of that person you really admire and respect, you'd really probably put it in a very nice place. You wouldn't be sort of, you know, putting it on the floor somewhere, would you? So that's sort of what it's suggesting here.
For me, in addition to respect, I think reverence would include a quality of deep gratitude.
Yeah, gratitude, yeah, sure.
So all these precepts that what they're described here seem to me like attitudes that you have towards, again, Dharma, Sangha, and Buddha. When you go to like a Buddha center, like they talk about taking precepts, and sometimes you need to take them with the geshe or...
Okay, yeah. Yeah, that was the next point I was going to mention here. So let's go to that. So then if we go down to the bottom of page 11, there's an outline that says the benefits as they appear in personal instruction. So this is the benefits of going for refuge. And the first one is you are included among Buddhists. So And I think we saw earlier, it said that, you know, taking refuge is really the entry point into the Dharma, you know, to really take refuge in Buddha Dhamma Sangha. And so we can do this refuge in a very formal way. We can do what's called a refuge ceremony, where you go through this formal ceremony of formally making a commitment that I believe that this is the way I want to follow my life. I want to entrust myself to Buddha Dharma Sangha. That's what I want to do. That's the way I want to lead my life. So you can go through this refuge ceremony. And then it said that you become Buddhist. So to become Buddhist then, in this sense, means to have made that formal commitment to do that. And within that, at this level, then what we have, see, we can take refuge in Buddha Dharma Sangha at many levels. And what we find is that generally with the refuge ceremony, then we can take these precepts, or sometimes they're called vows. They're called pratimoksha vows or individual liberation vows. And so as we're going to see in the next outline on karma, that the at the foundation level of practice, what we are to do as the foundation practice to ensure a good future is to have ethical lifestyle. And so therefore, when we do this refuge ceremony, then often we have the opportunity to take these pratimoksha vows, which are precepts or vows to help us to engage in ethical lifestyle. So as a lay person, then usually this can take the form of five vows or five precepts of not killing, not stealing, not lying, no sexual misconduct, and no intoxicants. Intoxicants means drugs and alcohol. So we can take these precepts as part of that refuge ceremony as a basis for helping us to engage in an ethical lifestyle. So that is that what you were referring to?
Yeah. I guess the precepts, you can't really take them until you already run for a refuge.
Well, of course... See, we can, of course, ourselves decide ethically, I don't want to kill, I don't want to steal. I mean, we can do that now. But taking these precepts is, again, sort of making that formal commitment. See, I mean, of course, like example is, you know, we may find a person, a partner that we want to share our life with, or we may just decide, let's do that. Let's stay together for our life as partners. But often then people, to make that a formal commitment, they do the marriage ceremony. In the marriage ceremony, we make that formal commitment to the partner. And that can be quite helpful because if we don't do that, then what can happen, of course, is when things get a bit difficult, we go, oh, this is all too much. See you later. I'm out of here. But if we've gone through that marriage ceremony, made that commitment, then more likely we are trying to work through that difficulty and not just giving up. So likewise here, of course we can now just of our own thinking say, I really want to be ethical, I don't want to do this, don't want to do that. But if we do this formal, taking these precepts, we're making a formal commitment, and that's going to help often sustain that better. We'll be able to try and be that ethical more, in a more sustainable way. So that's what the precepts are about. It's just really making that into a very formal commitment. And then that will really help us to maintain that ethical level in our life.
It seems like the commitments don't like do anything magical. Perhaps it could be suggested in Christianity, like when you kind of sign up, there's kind of something magic is kind of supposed to happen. And it sounds like in Buddhism, it's like, no.
Magic.
Yeah. You know. There's supposed to be this, like, you know, divine change, whatever is supposed to be taking place. Whereas in Buddhism, it sounds like, no, you just made a decision, and you're making a formal commitment to the decision. Now you've got a lot of work to do in front of you.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I mean, I don't think... See, the thing is that one of the things that can happen, unfortunately, with this, like, refuge ceremony or taking these precepts... is that people go through the ceremony and they go, okay, now I'm a Buddhist. Everything's fine. Everything's good. And then they walk around saying, I'm a Buddhist, I'm a Buddhist. And then you look at their behavior and they're not really improving. So, you know, we need to understand what this is and not think that just because we've done a refuge, you know, refuge ceremony somehow that we're really a Buddhist. I mean, it's the same, I think, a little bit in Christianity, you know. You ask someone, oh, I'm a Christian. Why are you Christian? Oh, I was sort of baptized, or I was growing up, my parents were Christian. Does that really make us Christian? I'm not sure. You know, same thing. Just because we've gone through a refuge ceremony some time ago, I mean, really, are we a Buddhist or not? I mean, of course, what we're really, you know, are we really trying to follow the Dharma in our life or not? That's really if we're Buddhist or not. If we're, I mean, we can do all sorts of ceremonies forever, but again, so if we do them in a good way, then we're just making that formal commitment. Then, of course, like you said, that's when we really start to implement the precepts and implement the Dharma. One thing I'd like to add to that, and then we'll move on to the next topic, is that, so generally, it's said that we become a Buddhist when we take refuge in the three jewels. But this is really becoming a Buddhist in terms of conduct. We can also talk about becoming a Buddhist or being a Buddhist in terms of our philosophical view. And there are what's called the four seals, which are four philosophical statements. And if we accept those four philosophical statements, we can be said to be a Buddhist in terms of our philosophical view. Generally, these four seals were used historically to determine whether or not a text was Buddhist. If the text was in agreement or in line with these four philosophical views or statements, it could be said to be a Buddhist text. But equally well, we can apply that to the person. In fact, this book here I've read from, What Makes You Not a Buddhist, is all about these four seals. That's the whole book, is all about that. So I thought it would be nice to just briefly mention what these four seals are, because they will come up later when we start to talk about the Vipassana practice, the insight practice. The first of the four statements is that all compounded phenomena are impermanent. What we mean by a compounded phenomena is any phenomena that's created through causes and conditions. So anything that's created through causes and conditions is impermanent. And here, of course, impermanent means changing moment by moment. So that's the first statement. Everything produced through causes and conditions is changing moment by moment. So, meaning there is nothing that is produced through causes and conditions that is stable or static. The second statement is that all contaminated phenomena are suffering. Here, what we mean by contaminated phenomena, it means that it's talking about all the things that we experience, because all of the phenomena that we experience is through the contamination of the mental afflictions, is because of our contaminated mind. So, and suffering here, of course, is the translation of the word dukkha. So what we're basically saying in the second statement is that all of the things which we experience, all of our experiences are dukkha. So effectively the first noble truth. The third statement is that all phenomena are empty and selfless. What these two words, empty and selfless, means changes a little bit within different philosophical schools within Buddhism. But all philosophical schools in Buddhism say that all phenomena are empty and selfless. And we're going to be talking about these two ideas, of course, in the Vipassana section of the Lam Rim text. And the fourth statement is that Nirvana is peace. Here the word peace means that Nirvana is a state completely pacified of all mental afflictions and suffering. So, Nirvana is a state of liberation, freedom from suffering and its causes. So these four statements, if we accept those four philosophical statements, we can be said to be a Buddhist, at least in terms of our philosophical view. And so we'll be looking at these various statements as we go through the Lam Rim. I mean, we've already sort of looked at the second one, and we're going to look at that again very shortly. We've already looked at the first one a little bit, the idea of impermanence, and these are we're going to talk more about later. Any questions about those? Yes.
Did you say again that all of our experience, every experience is contaminated?
Yeah. Yeah, because our mind is contaminated by the mental afflictions.
Every thought, anything that comes up in the mind.
It is contaminated, yeah. So it can be contaminated in a number of ways. And at the very most subtle level, the contamination is that we believe that there's a me here experiencing that thing there. Believing that there's subject-object duality. That's at the sort of very subtlest level of contamination.
So even the wish for all beings to be free from suffering or the aspiration for enlightenment, those are contaminated?
At our level, yes. Yes. So we need to go through in stages. Of course, a worse contamination is that we have mental affliction such as anger, which leads to non-virtuous behavior. So that's a more heavy sort of contamination, because it leads to suffering. But even, as you said, our wish to liberate sentient beings from suffering, that wish is contaminated. That wish is based on there's a me here, and a sentient being's there who I want to liberate.
But you can't.
But that's where we start, because it's better that than I want to harm those people because they're getting in my way. So that's sort of moving in the right direction. So that's why at the first level here, the first level is to stop harming others.
So you mean there's hope?
Yes, there's hope. and then we need to work on our wisdom practice. We need to come to realize that there's no independent me, no independent sentient beings to liberate. And then our wish for them to be free of suffering can become uncontaminated. But that happens a little bit later in the spiritual path. But it will happen.
I have questions about
Nirvana,
shall
we? Sure. well, I'll ask the question, I'll either answer or...
A couple of them. Like,
sure.
We talk about the moments of the mind.
Mm-hmm.
So is Nirvana, once achieved, is it a continuous state of mind, or is it still moments of mind? And like the Velveteen Rabbit, does it happen all at once or bit by bit?
So actually, okay, you know, we talk about the continuum of the mind, and we said we can sort of break it up into moments, but that's sort of just to understand things. I mean, are there discrete moments of mind? No. It's a flow. Just like the physical world is a flow. But we break up that physical flow into discrete moments to make sense of it. So likewise, there's a continuous flow, and we break it up into these discrete moments to understand the cause and effect of our experiences and so forth. And that's fine. But there is no discrete moments. There's just a continuous change. Yeah. And within that continuous change, then we can transform the mind. And then at some point, we will manage to eliminate all contamination from the mind. So before, then we're in samsara. And then after we've finally liberated the contamination from the mind, we're in nirvana.
So it's a steady state.
Yeah. And it's not, and you can't go back. It's one-way ticket.
Well, we want to go back.
Yeah, that's true.
But,
because to have contamination, you need a cause.
Right. But you're ditching contamination along the way.
Yeah, yeah. There's less and less contamination.
Okay.
Yeah, hopefully. Otherwise, we're not going to get there. Yes. So that's what we're doing, is we're getting rid of this contamination layer upon layer upon layer, and more subtle levels of contamination. And the most subtle level of contamination we get rid of here, and then it's gone.
Is the state of nirvana the result of our practice?
Technically, nirvana is not a result. It's a technical point. Because nirvana, see, what we're doing is we are producing a mind that is free from contamination. And nirvana technically is that absence of contamination. So technically it's not produced. I don't want to go into it, but yeah. It doesn't really matter anyway, but it's just a little technical point. But through the process of removing the contamination, then we have that state of nirvana. Is there something else in the question?
Well, if it's not produced and it's not impermanent, then I guess it's permanent. And in some sense, it seems to me it must be present now.
So when we talk about impermanent and permanent, see, the word permanent and impermanent here, I mean, normally when we see permanent, for us it means lasts forever. That's not the meaning here. And for us, impermanent means doesn't last forever. That's not the meaning of permanent and impermanent in the Buddhist texts. Literally, the words from Sanskrit and Tibetan is changing and unchanging. So permanent and impermanent do not indicate how long something lasts. Permanent and impermanent is simply saying, is this thing changing from moment to moment or not? If it is changing moment to moment, it's impermanent. If it's not changing from moment to moment, it's permanent. There are many things which are permanent and do not last forever, and there are things which are impermanent that last forever. What's an impermanent thing that lasts forever? Our mind. Our mind is changing moment by moment. It's impermanent. But there's no beginning and no end. What is a permanent phenomena that's not lasting forever? Nirvana, samsara. Nirvana, well, again, it depends really how the nirvana is defined, and in different philosophical systems in Buddhism, it's defined slightly differently. But within the one we're following, nirvana is defined as the emptiness of the mind, free of afflictions. And so that comes into existence at the point when the contamination is gone. But that's not changing moment by moment. Okay. Let's now go on to the next topic. Okay. Sure.
Okay. My understanding is that Nirvana actually is the true, our true mind. Well, we are contaminated, just like we are dusted by many things. And once you remove those dust, then you show the true self. So it's already there. Is the way to show it.
So again, it depends how we define the word Nirvana. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that later, I think, in the context of Vipassana. But we can also talk about this, as you said, this deepest level of our mind, which is not contaminated by the mental afflictions. And so that is present now, yes. But within the system we're following here, Nirvana, and of course, at the time of Nirvana, then this becomes manifest. But the word Nirvana in this system is not pointing to that. So it depends on how the word Nirvana is defined. That's all.
Another question. Can one reach Nirvana without taking refuge?
Depends what you mean by that. I mean, to achieve Nirvana, we need to realize the nature of reality directly and eliminate all the mental afflictions and ignorance. So do we have to be a Buddhist to achieve Nirvana? No. But according to Buddhism, to reach Nirvana, you have to have a correct understanding and realization of the nature of reality and then eliminate the mental afflictions and ignorance based on that. Whether you call yourself a Buddhist or not, I think is not important.
There are blessings from Buddha once you take the refuge, so it will empower you to go faster than...
Because the Buddha realized this himself, and he gave very clear teachings on how to achieve that goal. Does the Buddha have mortgage on that? No. So, yes, the Buddhist teachings give very clear instructions on how to achieve that goal. Could there be instructions in other traditions that enable us to achieve that goal? Yes. I don't know. Maybe. Are they very clearly explained? Maybe yes, maybe not.
I personally feel that there are certain energy come from Buddha, if you can refugee, then it's a blessing, it's an empowerment, more than just what he say in the text.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, sure. And I think this points to the idea of this interdependent nature of everything, and we're going to touch on that later in the Vipassana section. Okay, so then if we go on to the next topic here, which is then on the near the top of page 12, it says, developing faith of conviction that is the root of all temporary happiness and certain goodness. And, of course, this is talking about the topic of karma. And in that first paragraph there, halfway long, it says, the proper view of dependent arising and the causality of the two types of karma
is the indispensable foundation for the practices of all vehicles and the aims of all beings. You should look at other scriptures as well to develop an intense and enduring certainty. Take this to be a goal of crucial importance. So here we're talking about understanding karma in terms of law of cause and effect, in terms of our actions and our experiences. Now, in this presentation, then, sometimes people have some difficulties with some of the parts of the presentation, and often the difficulty comes because of our assumptions. Now we have this, generally we have this assumption that there's a me here and an independent objective world out there. And so if we go into this discussion about karma based on this assumption, there probably will be some things in the presentation which won't make sense. Because this presentation, of course, is a presentation of cause and effect. It's part of the interdependent nature of reality. And so actually to highlight that, if we go down to page 14, about halfway down, or two-thirds of the way down, there's an outline that says how to engage in virtue and turn away from non-virtue. And then under that it talks about a general explanation. Then if we read the second sentence there, it says, some who claim that they have acquired certain knowledge of emptiness, and of course emptiness is talking about the nature of reality, are uncertain about karma and its effects and do not value it. This is a mistaken understanding of emptiness. For once you understand emptiness, you will see that it is the meaning of dependent arising, and it will assist you in becoming certain about karma and its effects. Which means that to really appreciate what karma, the principle of karma is talking about, then it's very helpful to understand the Buddhist view of reality, the idea of emptiness, the idea of dependent arising, interdependency. So if we can keep that in mind in this discussion, and then later when we go through the nature of reality section, the Vipassana section, and try to understand the Buddhist view of reality, and then we can use that and come back and look at the karma topic again through that perspective, we may get a different understanding. So just to be aware of that. So let's have a look at karma. And actually, first off, the word karma literally means action. But of course, this principle or topic of karma is talking about not just about our actions, it's talking about the law of cause and effect with respect to our actions. So then, within this topic, we can talk about three phases of the process. There is the actual karma, which is the action. And then every action we do with the motivation leaves what's called an imprint in our mind. So this is called often the imprint of karma. And that imprint of our action then later, sometime later, ripens as an experience. And so that is the result of karma, is our experiences. So in the topic of karma, we often talk about this whole process then. What are the various actions?
then the imprints they create, and then what sorts of results do we get from those actions. So we're going to talk about this whole process. But technically, the word karma is talking about action.
So actually, there's another part of the presentation of karma a little bit later in the outlines that I'd like to bring in now. So on page 17, if you go down on page 17, down towards the bottom, there's an outline that says how you thereby accumulate karma. And there we have two outlines. The first one says karma that is intention and karma that is intended action.
So when we look at karma or action, what are we really pointing to is the mental factor of intention. So then we can talk about these two types of karma then. We can talk about the intention itself. And we can talk about the intended actions. So intention here is mental. Whereas the intended actions are the verbal and physical actions that come from that intention. So intended actions is our verbal and physical actions. So karma can be mental, verbal, or physical. So even having a thought with intention is karma itself. But then, of course, we can act on that intention verbally or physically. But we can have mental, verbal, or physical actions. And then also here in that section, the one before, it says, in general, karma is of three types: virtuous, non-virtuous, and neutral. So virtuous karma or virtuous actions is any action that leads to a happiness result. Non-virtuous karma or non-virtuous action is any action that leads to a suffering result. And neutral action is any action that leads to a neutral result. So we can talk about three types of actions or karma because we can talk about three types of experiences. Either happiness, pleasant experience, suffering, unpleasant experience, or neutral experience. Because actions lead to results, to experiences. So we can have three types of experiences, so therefore we have three types of actions that lead to those three types of experiences. Any questions about anything so far?
What if the intention is virtuous, but the actual outcome is
harmful? Right. Okay, a couple of things to say here. First is a lot of our actions are mixed. We may have a good intention, but not much wisdom, and we create suffering. So then the result is mixed. You get both results. One other thing, which I was going to bring up later, but now that you've asked the question, I'll bring it in now, is that, you know, sometimes people talk about instant karma. No such thing. Because we can have this analogy, use this as an analogy of planting a seed in the ground. You know, planting the seed is like planting the imprint. If we plant a seed in the ground, do we instantly get a tree? No. It takes time for that result to manifest, mature. Likewise, when you do an action, that plants an imprint in our mind. It takes time for that to ripen. How long? We're going to talk about a little bit later in the presentation. But there is a maturation time. So what we need to do is to distinguish between, see, every time we do an action, there are at least two things happening. There is this, and this is going to come much later. But of course, every action we do has an immediate impact on ourselves and others. That immediate impact is not the result. So, for example, concrete example. Let's say we steal some money from a person. So we steal the money. We get an imprint for stealing. What is the result of that stealing? As we're going to see in one of the principles of karma very soon, that a result of that stealing is that sometime in the future, near future, further, we are going to experience someone stealing from us. That's the result of stealing. But what's the immediate impact of that stealing? Is we have money in our hand. So did stealing produce money? According to this principle, impossible. Is stealing the cause for having money? No.
So we did something good in the past that brought money into our hand?
Yeah. So, see, the thing is that if stealing is the cause of money, if two things are in a cause-effect relationship, it means whenever you have the cause, you get the result. Do we always get money if we try to steal? No, sometimes we get caught and we end up in jail. So stealing is not the cause of money. So therefore, you know, people say, but, you know, people do stealing and they end up with a good experience. That's not the result. That's just an immediate consequence. That's what we tend to do because two things happen one after the other. We link them together. They must be in a cause-effect relationship. But that's not very scientific, you know. That just because one thing follows another, therefore that must be the cause for that. That's where we go wrong. That's the problem. But anyway, I'm going to talk more about that coming up.
With the theory of independency, though, how can a result be virtuous or non-virtuous purely because it's going to impact throughout? It's not just ourselves.
I didn't catch the question.
So what? Well, no, it's like, okay, if we divorce ourselves from the me, and we are all independent, okay, we're all one big soup of existence.
No, we are not.
But I can't see how a result could be virtuous.
No, the cause, the action is virtuous, the result is happiness.
Okay, but I don't know, I just think it affects others around us.
Of course.
So I don't know how it can be plainly virtuous or non-virtuous, because it might affect them differently.
One thing is that karma is personal.
Okay.
We can't take someone's karma, we can't give them karma.
Okay.
We can't do that. Of course, we can affect other people as a condition for them to behave in a certain way. So we have a responsibility to not act as a condition for others to engage in harmful behavior. But we can't cause someone to behave negatively. We can only be a condition.
Okay.
Yeah, we're not the cause. Likewise, you know, we sometimes get angry and we say, that person is the cause of my anger. Not true. What's the cause of our anger? Our habit of getting angry. That person happens to act as a condition for our habit of getting angry to manifest. So the cause of our anger is our habit of anger. Because if we don't have a habit of anger, someone can do whatever they want. We won't get angry, will we? They're not the cause. They're a condition. But they're still a condition. So we, from our side, should not try to be a condition that will precipitate negative behavior in others.
Does a thought alone create an imprint and possibly a result?
Yes.
Okay.
So if we have a thought, I want to hurt that person,
yes,
that is karma. But, of course, there's a big difference between having that thought and acting it out. So one of the presentations coming up is the weight of karma.
Okay.
Yeah. So there's a huge difference between having merely a thought of wishing to hurt someone and actually saying or harming someone. Big difference.
Okay.
But it still is action. Let's take a break because we've run over a bit. So let's take a break. Come back at 10:45 and then we'll continue on. There's a lot more to speak about karma.